it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
I'm Amy. I'm the producer of Rebel Steps. I do a lot of the editing and I do the website.
I'm Liz. I'm the host and I do a lot of the research and writing for Rebel Steps.
Well, awesome. Well, let's just talk about Rebel Steps. I remember when it came out and it's now part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network, like It's Going Down is as well. But let's talk about the goal of the project and just kind of the thought behind what caused it to start in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. So Rebel Steps is a podcast about taking action and building organizing skills. We originally started it kind of a year or so after the 2016 election, and we were really reacting to a lot of the calls after that election to call your senator or read a book or donate. And there was like also a lot of media about how everything was wrong, you know, but not a lot about what you could actually do, you know, to start making progress towards fixing some of these things that were wrong. And so we really wanted to present an easy path and like help people kind of take those rebel steps into, you know, leftist organizing and taking action that was more aligned with like direct action and mutual aid, and those kind of things. So we really drill down like into step by step of like how you can really get involved. And the goal is really to like welcome new people and grow a movement of organizers, right? We want a leaderful movement where everyone is able to contribute. And so, yeah, that's like one of the big goals. And then we also always we always have these big moments, right? Like 2016, you know, most recently coronavirus and the George Floyd rebellion, where we have all these new people kind of activated. So we really wanted a way to sort of capture each of those moments and feed people into more long-term organizing.
Just to add to that, a few ways that we try to make it extra inviting are just kind of by staying away from jargon. And we also try and start from the very beginning. So we don't want to assume that our listeners already know things about leftist politics or about getting involved. And we also try to add some historical context to those actions. So, for example, when we talk about rent strikes, we touch on the history of rent strikes, particularly in New York City. So really trying to root the actions we're taking today in a really long lineage of political action. And also another element that we touch on is just that getting politically involved isn't actually just about skills. A lot of it is kind of this like emotional element of feeling like you can do something, that it's possible to do something, and that you'll be welcome in these groups where things are happening. So that's something we also try and talk about, like, so kind of trying to take on, for example, imposter syndrome head on, trying to take on kind of the feeling of hopelessness some of us feel sometimes head on. So those are a few other things that we think about when we're creating these episodes.
Yeah, I just think it's so great that you all really seem to have like your finger on the pulse of the zeitgeist whenever stuff pops off, and you're able to produce shows that allow people to think about getting involved and becoming involved in organizing. I'm just curious real quick, have you gotten a lot of feedback?
Yeah. So a lot of it comes through Twitter, which is sort of, you know, the place we all get feedback for better or for worse. But there have been some really nice moments where people are like, oh, I tried a new thing because I listened to this episode. Or people will email us and be like, I listened to this episode and I had this follow-up question. And like, where can I find out more? So that's always really great. One time somebody on Twitter said they listened to our first season 3 times. And I found that to be one of the more charming compliments, because that's just... that's a lot of listening to my voice. So kudos to that person for being able to handle that. But yeah, people there, you know, it does seem to resonate with people, which is really great to hear.
Well, the other thing we're going to be talking about is, in many ways, New York has been this really intense epicenter for so many of the things that made 2020 stand out, from the pandemic to the housing crisis, the riots and the uprising that broke out after the police murder of George Floyd, you know, everything with Trump. I'm just curious, before we kind of jump in to like pick all that apart, what are your initial thoughts, if you have any, like, kind of either grand lessons learned or things, like, when you look back at the year? I'm really curious, you know, what you all thoughts are on 2020.
Yeah, well, one thing I do want to note is that with New York being kind of called an epicenter, there's some really interesting things going on with New York as a city. So for one thing, we do have a lot of media here. Like, so when things happen in New York, they do tend to get a little more attention. And also, on the other hand, though, we do have like 3% of the so-called U.S. population. So we do just have like a lot of people here and a lot of things happening. But I think one thing I just wanted to highlight going into this is that, like, 2020, I think one of the things that was so interesting and moving is that we did have things breaking out. Like, we had protests happening all over the world, really. And we also had like small towns that don't usually come out. So I just want to, you know, highlight that just sort of at the top, that even though New York did have a lot of interesting things going on, it wasn't unique in that, like, many small communities also had like lots of interesting things going on. But with that, as far as my initial thoughts, I think 2020, as it has been for most of us, which has just been very overwhelming. So I think I'm still really sorting through what I want to take from the past year and what I'm going to carry with me. But as we'll get into the interview, I think I'll have some more reflections as well. But yeah, it's been a very intense time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's definitely overwhelming still to think about what, you know, what was 2020. I think one thing that's coming to mind right now is that, like, there was such a sudden and rapid change in, like, our everyday lives in 2020. And I think that, even though it was a, you know, primarily bad change, it really, like, you know, it does show that, like, the, like, big sudden changes in, like, how we are as a society, like, are possible. I think that was, like, an interesting aspect of, like, all of the, you know, all of the big changes happening at once in 2020. And also with New York, you know, like any other kind of cities that are very dense, like, I think there is, like, an even larger, like, change in, like, day-to-day life, than there is in, like, you know, if you live in the suburbs, like, you know, our parents do, like, you don't have to wear a mask all the time because it's, like, no one else is in your backyard. But, you know, like, when, you know, in New York and in denser cities, like, there really is, like, our day-to-day lives have completely changed. They just changed on a dime back in March, you know, so it's, you know, I don't know, that's an interesting aspect.
You know, just as one other follow-up question, I'm curious, you know, like, have the events of the past year, both in terms of just, you said, like, society changing really, really fast, has that given you more hope or more pessimism in terms of just, you know, humanity in general, but also as an anarchist?
I think almost I want to say yes. Like, obviously, like I said, the changes in 2020 were, you know, dramatically bad, primarily, but I think it is, like, you know, there is kind of this feeling of, like, with climate change, I feel like in particular, like, any of the major crises that we have in society right now, that it's like, oh, it's, like, overwhelming to think about changing society to, like, fix these problems. And it's like, well, if we really had to, which we do, but, like, you know, if there really was, you know, the powers that be decided to change them and fix them, they could, you know, and I think that is something that is, you know, hopeful in some way, you know, that it's like, if there was the power in a big movement to change these things, they could be changed.
Yeah, I would, just to add to that, I also feel like I do have some hope coming out of 2020, basically because it was the first time in my life that I really experienced a truly mass movement, which I think that, like, in May and June, it was just really unprecedented. And that's really powerful to see. And also all those people that apparently for the first time, it felt like were really out in the streets, not only in New York, but all over the world. All those people are now kind of, like, activated in a new way that they wouldn't have been if they hadn't had that experience of being in the streets with all these people. So I really think that in a lot of ways, 2020 is just sort of like the beginning of the next chapter. And we don't know really where it's going to go. Like, it's true, it could go very dystopian for a while. But it, to me, that glimmer of, like, a truly mass movement is really something that I'm holding on to.
In terms of the coronavirus now, we're over past 400,000 deaths due to the pandemic. I wanted to ask you, since you're in New York, you know, Andrew Cuomo, especially in like CNN or MSNBC, a lot of like the legacy neoliberal media was really presented as sort of this like front line of resistance, really stood up to Trump, in regards to the coronavirus response, along with, you know, people like, you know, the governor of California. But I'm just curious, you know, from your perspective, like looking back at everything, having experienced it, I'm curious, you know, both as anarchists and just people living there, what would you say about the state's response to the pandemic, and how does that reality meet up to sort of the media spectacle?
Yeah, I would say that it's just completely off. You know, the media like likes to play up, you know, the sort of like conservative versus liberal, you know, battle sort of vibes. But like, you know, Cuomo really like put the city in and the state in a position of like not having enough health facilities like in the first place. And then he also like literally like, you know, de Blasio and city officials wanted to shut down the city like several weeks earlier. And he like stopped that from happening, causing like many, 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 you know, more deaths. So I just, you know, definitely like the initial response was bad. And then we've continued to see a really bad response. Like, you know, testing is still an arduous, getting tested for COVID in New York City is still an arduous process. You know, it can still take you hours. The vaccine rollout has also been a disaster. Like Cuomo even at one point had imposed two separate fines, one for giving the vaccine to someone who was not eligible and one for not using the vaccines quickly enough. So it was really like, you know, that it's like, oh, you aren't giving them fast enough, but all, oh, be careful, don't give them to the wrong person, you know, putting healthcare facilities in this like really bind, you know, this binding situation of like no win, you know, lose-lose. So really like, you know, it was really kind of a bizarre in the spring to see the media kind of be so hyped on Cuomo and what a great job he was doing. And then in the city being like, wait, what? No, like this is not, you know, this is not a good response to this situation.
Yeah, he's also constantly feuding with our mayor, which is also just a complete waste of time and resources and energy. And it's really awful. I think one of the things that's been frustrating is that Trump kind of put the bar so low for a leader that now Cuomo is like amazing to some of these networks. And it seems kind of bizarre to me because it's like, okay, if Trump is like the worst ever, as many people will claim, then we should have a higher bar than better than Trump. But it sort of feels like with Cuomo, it's just like, well, he can hold a decent press conference. So he has passed that bar. So we're going to like kind of lionize him. The other thing I wanted to just add to that is that New York often kind of like postures as sort of like the resistance, but there's not a lot of like teeth to that. So for example, like de Blasio even ran on like reforming the NYPD, but now has just like consistently just defended them, even in the midst of like just horrendous video footage being out there. He even like claimed to not have seen the footage at one point in order to like not condemn the NYPD. So in New York, there's this really interesting thing where by sort of like posturing as like the anti-Trump or as like quote unquote resistance or like quote unquote like pro-science, they sort of like get away with being like, in my opinion, pretty reactionary and like conservative in other ways. But they're like, oh, look, like we're doing this right thing. So even just like a couple of days ago, Cuomo tweeted like how we have to keep the economy open. And this is when we're facing like higher rates of coronavirus than we did in March. So I think that that's like a really, I think it just shows that, you know, it's like, look, here it is a year later. You still haven't learned anything. You didn't shut down the city when you needed to in March. And now here you are. You're like stopping businesses from like protecting their employees. You're stopping people from like staying at home and staying safe. So yeah, Cuomo.
Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting point that you brought up, that like the infrastructure was never really there to like serve people in general. So that when the pandemic hit, you know, obviously you're going to have a response that's going to be lackluster to people's needs because it was never designed that way anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, you know, I mentioned Cuomo and kind of New York health facilities, but also like just, you know, health insurance and the fact that we don't have public health insurance and we don't have Medicare for all, or, you know, it's just like our society is not set up to support human needs. And so it's like the least surprising thing ever that we couldn't handle a health crisis.
You know, after the pandemic broke, we saw just an outpouring of mutual aid projects. I'm just curious if you could comment on this. You know, there's been obviously a lot of stuff that's been going on in New York.
Yeah. It's been amazing, and I would say it's still going strong. So, for example, in Brooklyn, you'll see there's a lot of free fridges around. eviction of defense and stoop watches, which I think are a type of mutual aid, have really come into focus in the past like month or so, as sort of like landlords are kind of turning to illegal evictions now since they can't legally evict people. So that's something that's like growing as well. And if anything, I think all these efforts are getting stronger because people have really found their place. They've grown skills over the past year. There's more infrastructure there. I'd say it's been really amazing to see. And it's like a really great demonstration of what people are capable of when they work together as a community.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been really cool. I feel like with the kind of lockdown and people staying home, there's a lot more like neighborhood centric organizing and like hyper local organizing going on, which I think is really cool. Just as sort of like an anecdote, I had like a space heater that I needed to like, that I didn't need anymore. And I was able to contact like a local, you know, a group that's been doing mutual aid and food drop offs and donate and like, you know, helping doing mutual aid in my neighborhood. And I contacted them and I was like, oh, I have this space heater. Like, does anyone need it? And they're like, oh yeah, like let me try and find someone. And they found like, you know, just a random neighbor who needed a space heater. And like, it's very small, but like those kind of like really like where you're like, oh, it's like a community just sort of like helping meet each other's needs, I think is like really, really beautiful. And like, you know, literally a year ago, I might have just taken that to, you know, a Goodwill or a Housing Works sort of like place to just drop it off and donate it to like a faceless, you know, organization. And so, you know, instead I got to like literally go drive this, you know, I drove it like a mile from my house and dropped it off, you know, at someone's house who really needed it. So it's been really cool to have those like really those like neighborhood groups spring up in the midst of, you know, COVID.
You know, one other thing, it sounds like the retention of people has been pretty strong. Like people have stuck around, even though it seems like a lot of people in big cities are reporting that sort of like, you know, the crowds for demonstrations have kind of gotten smaller now that Biden has won. I'm just curious if you could kind of speak to that dynamic. Like, has there been a retention of people like involved in like actual projects, even if maybe protests have gotten smaller, or what are you all seeing in terms of that?
Yeah, just because it's only been a couple days, I don't know if I can speak too much on the direct correlation there between Biden and participation, but you know, a lot of our podcast is about taking people beyond protesting because I know that demonstrations are an important part of any movement, but there's so much work that goes on behind the scenes, as I'm sure you know as well. So, you know, even just like minding a hotline number for people who need assistance, sending people information about resources that are available, or you know, being part of those groups that connect people who have like a space heater to something else. Okay. These things don't make the front lines of newspapers all the time. They might not look like huge, but in my opinion, that's actually like almost like harder to do to like really get involved. And it might be, it's like at least as important as getting into the streets. So in the past year, I feel like I've been really heartened by the participation I'm seeing. And I think the goal should be when we look at these big demonstrations, the goal should be to activate all those people to like take the next step, which is really what our podcast is about. So, and like those people all, they took the first step to get into the streets, which is awesome. And they're still here in New York. They're still or wherever they are. And they're ripe to take that next step into like some other sort of like long-term organizing. The other thing I would say is that like, I feel like every winter people get like a little down about participation and like, maybe it sounds a little silly, but like seasonal depression is a real thing. It's really cold out. People don't want to go stand around in the cold unless they feel like they really need to. So I wouldn't be surprised if we do have big demonstrations again or more participation when spring comes around. But I think we do have to realize that like there are cycles to life as humans. And one of those cycles is that winter is like a very hard time for people to like get involved in things and try new things.
Yeah, the other thought I have on that is that like, right, if we think of like, what is our end goal as a movement, right? It's not to have the biggest demonstration ever. You know, our end goal is to like have communities that can run themselves and, you know, to have a society that can support human needs. And the real work towards that is the day-to-day organizing of like building a community organization and meeting your neighbors and like, you know, and sharing food and like all this sort of stuff. And like, you know, the demonstrations are so important and I don't want to downplay those at all, but the end goal is not to have the biggest demonstration. So, you know, I think it's really important to be trying to encourage people to get involved in the sort of, you know, quote unquote, less glamorous parts of organizing that are sort of long-term, day-to-day work.
Yeah, just as like a side note to that, we recently did put out Street Action episodes, but we actually avoided doing that for a long time. We only did it because a lot of people ask about it. But we avoided it just because so many people think that activism starts and ends with street action. And even just the street action requires, for example, medics and legal aid and jail support and all these other things that are just really behind the scenes. So even with talking about action, I always try and emphasize how much like infrastructure is going on behind the scenes, because I also think that when we emphasize just street action, it really like disincentivizes people who can't do street action or don't want to do street action from getting involved. So it's like, we might not have like big demos every day right now in January, but I think we do have more people involved in day-to-day things than we have for a very long time. And I think that we will continue to see more involvement going forward.
On the show, we've had the chance to talk to people in Brooklyn that have been on Rent Strike. And we know that you all have done some amazing shows on just how people can go on Rent Strike, how they can get involved in tenant organizing. Can you speak on just kind of the housing situation that's been going on in New York since the pandemic and just kind of the scope of the rent strikes? I think to me, that's a really interesting question because it seems like there's been kind of like a few big days of action that have gotten the attention of the media, but it seems over the long term, there's just been like a slow boil, at least from our vantage point, from what we're seeing, not in New York, but there's been a slow boil of just continuous housing action, rent strikes and stuff that's been going on. So I was just curious if you could speak to what you're seeing on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I think this is another interesting point when we talk about like participation being up or down, because I think sometimes like a demo that under normal circumstances would seem like really big, now it's like, well, we're having like housing actions, or we're having these actions like literally every week, so maybe it's not that big, but it's like, no, wait, we never used to do all this stuff that we're doing, so this is incredible. But yeah, it's sort of strange. So I'm interested to see how the housing situation develops, because there hasn't been any cohesive plan anywhere that I can tell for how to deal with people that cannot pay rent. So like the landlords aren't being assisted at all. The tenants aren't really being assisted. There's just these sort of like amorphous eviction moratoriums. And like the CDC one at the federal level is incredibly kind of useless. Like it literally makes you claim that you do owe this rent, which like legally, you really don't want to sign a piece of paper that says you owe that rent. And in New York, we have like a stronger one that is a little better. So that's good. But it's still like they just keep extending it and extending it. So you're right to like kind of call it like a slow boil, because basically you'll have like every so often a landlord is trying to attempt an illegal lockout or an illegal eviction of some kind. And then like activists will try and help out, or hopefully if people are aware of it. But it's sort of this sort of like almost like cat and mouse game or something. Like there hasn't been like the big epic battle yet. And I think it's because the government knows that if they started just evicting people, which keep in mind, the landlord might be the one who initiates the eviction, but the government, the police are the ones who are actually going to execute that eviction. If the police started just evicting everyone in New York, for example, that owed rent, there would be like mass hysteria. Like there would be no peace at all. So I think the government is right to not want to do that, but they just haven't figured out how they're going to actually stop it in the long haul. So right now, I think, you know, as far as on the side of like people who are organizing, the goal is to like continue building eviction defense infrastructure, continuing to get in touch with vulnerable tenants, trying to like work on the game plan for if kind of the wave of evictions is finally kind of like inflicted on tenants. But since that it hasn't happened yet, it's sort of like a waiting game, but it is good because it's giving everybody a chance to like work on those skills that they need to get in touch with the right people. And then I just wanted to highlight that we do the four episodes we have. We have four episodes on rent strike organizing and tenant organizing. One is about rent striking like in your building. The second one kind of talks about like next steps in history, like where a rent strike can lead. The third one talks about building a tenant union. And then the last one talks about eviction defense. And that last one, I would really recommend that everyone check out, just because no matter what your situation is, you can assist with eviction defense in some way. And I think that it's going to be like a battle we're going to have to fight over the next few months.
So the situation is still that all of these, both landlords and tenants, are just accumulating massive amounts of debt. I mean, I think one of the big questions is just like, how can that just continue? Like, how does that logically make sense that these people are just continuously racking up the debt? I mean, especially just with the landlords, like, what are they doing in this situation? If people aren't paying and they can't get them evicted.
Well, some of them are attempting these illegal lockouts. So that's like, just to be clear, that's like when a landlord comes in, threatens a tenant, tries to get them out, and changes all the locks. Or when the tenant leaves, they change all the locks, or like put like a, sometimes you'll even see like a chain or something like kind of intimidating on the door. So that is something that does happen. As far as like how it's working, I honestly don't know. I feel like it's like the most clear example that our whole society is based on monopoly money. Like, it's like, where was that rent money going? And now it's not going anywhere and people are still in their apartments. Like, it's incredibly confusing. I do know that, like, at least for a period of time, there was like mortgage assistance, which was very frustrating because early on in the pandemic, there was no eviction moratorium or rental assistance. But they were like, oh, we did some mortgage assistance. So, I mean, some landlords may be receiving some like assistance paying their mortgage. But I can't answer the question what landlords are doing really. But I do know that they are sending lots of nasty messages on forums and stuff, if what you believe on Twitter is correct.
There's also a dynamic in New York where a lot of housing is owned by these like big faceless corporations. Like, so almost every building in New York is owned by like fill in address LLC. So I, you know, like save as Liz, I don't really know what things are going on, right? But it's like none of the big developers in New York really like personally own any property. So I feel like there must be something there where it's just like, oh, well, they're just like letting that that LLC entity like take losses. And like, again, everything is like, money is literally made up. So it's like, I don't know, but it is very confusing. But I think it's similar to what I was saying about 2020 being like, oh wow, like, you know, society really can change pretty substantially, really rapidly, right? That it's like, yeah, okay, so now like no one paid rent, or like, you know, something like, you know, over 50% of renters in the US or something like didn't pay rent for like almost an entire year. And everything still was fine. And I think that that's like, can be really mind opening for a lot of people who are like, who do kind of buy into capitalism or buy into like, you know, kind of like basing a society around money. It's like, okay, well, like, wait, if I didn't pay rent and nothing bad happened, if, you know, what is actually going on here? Do we actually need this to be the way we give people housing?
Yeah. The other thing I would add to that is the way that landlords set up their businesses, like Amy said, with the like LLCs for each building. So like, you can look on through the records and you can see that like the LLCs all share a mailing address, but they aren't actually legally connected by anything really. So let's say one of your buildings is fine because it's in like a wealthy area of town. It doesn't really share anything with like whatever the, you know, rundown building in another area of town. So if one of your buildings isn't paying any rent, we can just declare bankruptcy as that LLC. But the rest of your buildings are still tainted by that LLC. So it's really kind of bizarre, but I would guess that that's something that's happening, or even like shuffling funds between mm-hmm. LLCs or something. I'm not sure, but they have found all sorts of ways to deal with it.
Yeah, real estate in New York is pretty atrociously bad.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at @IGD_news. In order for It's Going Down to continue into the future, though, we need your support. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to sign up to donate monthly or give us a one-time donation. Again, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and sign up to donate monthly or give us a one-time donation in order for us to grow our work into 2021. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to it. Well, let's turn now towards the rebellion. It's been 9 months or so since it kicked off following the police murder of George Floyd. I'm just curious, you know, I mean, it definitely grabbed headlines. What was going on in New York? You know, I've heard really interesting reports from people on the ground there. We've published a lot of stuff on it's going down, specifically about New York. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, in May and June, it was like such a powerful moment. It was very energizing. And I think it was, like we said earlier, like really made us feel like a mass movement is possible. You know, that it really, there is a mass of people that can be activated around these issues, and around like police brutality. I mean, it really feels like it's like starting something new, and that it really is starting like a new phase of a movement and of activism. It was also like in the street had a very like new feeling to me of having like broad public support. So like there were people, you know, in cars, you know, they used to honk at us to get out of the way, but now everyone was like honking in support. Like there was literally, I remember walking down the street and there was literally like people hanging out of every window of this apartment building, banging pots and like cheering us on. And that was just like so surreal. And it really made it feel like there is broad public support for like really changing how society is working.
Yeah. And to add to that public support feeling, you know, you would walk around and people would be handing out masks and water bottles and hand sanitizer. There was so much being given away that like there would just be piles of resources. Like there was no scarcity of any of these things at any protest, which I like never really experienced. Just people who weren't even with an organization or anything, just people who decided to show up with like a huge case of water bottles and hand them out. And then also like, even if you weren't in a protest, there was this sort of like spirit of excitement throughout the city. So like my partner and I were like on our way to a protest and we just had like little signs on our bikes that I had made. And somebody like starts honking and waving out the window at us and pointing at our signs and being like, yes, yeah, that's great. And like that's also something that it just like really felt like it brought everyone together in this really interesting way that, again, like, if you have an isolated protest, you don't feel that. And then you also had like these moments of like protests running into each other, or like passing each other, which again is like very surreal. Yeah, but I think the flip side of all that, there obviously wasn't all just revolutionary spirit. I think one of the real dangers in New York is sort of a liberal co-optation. So really quickly, like after the first few days, we saw people coming to sort of like peace police protests. So like, people would be at an anti-police protest and trying to stop people from chanting things that were anti-police and being like, no, we're not here for that. Or you would see people being like, oh, like, if the police kneel, they're on our side and things like that. And I think, you know, kind of going back to what I was saying even about Cuomo, where it's like, you know, you'd have people showing up to protest and sort of like posturing as this like quote unquote resistance, liberal person. And they were really just like siphoning energy off of the march. And that's something that's like, I think, really complicated in New York. And it's not that I have a great solution to it, but it's just like we didn't have the thing that stopped it wasn't like right wing stuff, or it wasn't even like the police were repressive, but that wasn't what stopped it. What really took the energy down was this sort of like recouping by the liberal political order.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like in New York, there is similar to what we're talking about with like kind of the posturing as the resistance against Trump. Like there is a really strong identity of being like quote unquote progressive. And it really, the co-optation is strong, like where, and people, you know, and it really, people react, are very reactionary, who are very liberal sometimes can be very reactionary where it's like, well, no, I'm a good person. And it's like, okay, but hold on, we're doing something different here, you know? So yeah, I think that, that is zapped a lot of energy pretty quickly.
Yeah, this seems to be kind of the main sort of like tension. This has been echoed across, you know, various cities and stuff like that. Do you have any thoughts to that? Like how we deal with that?
One thing in our street action episode we talked about was kind of treating those people as kind of disruptors to be de-escalated. So sort of, you know, kind of coming in and just sort of talking to them. Just not to change their mind, but to kind of distract them from kind of getting in the way of an action. And so the action can just like continue. So that's sort of like a very like tactical thing on the ground. A little more broadly, like I think we're in a new phase with Biden, you know, coming into office where, you know, we're going to be kind of up against more of that liberal pushback and that liberal co-optation versus the last 4 years when it's really clearly been, you know, anti-fascism was what was needed for that moment, because that's really what we were fighting. And I think now, you know, now we're going to have a moment where, you know, as a movement, as like the left broadly, we're going to need to get those skills and gain those skills around having these conversations and, you know, keeping our movement from being co-opted. So I think that's like, you know, I think that's something we need to be thinking about kind of as a movement.
Just one other question in terms of the rebellion. Do you feel like it changed anything in terms of people being called or viewing themselves as anarchists?
I'm not entirely sure how everyone views anarchists. I will say that burning down the police precinct in Minneapolis got some rave reviews, it seemed like, from the American public. Like, everyone seemed to think that they deserved it. As far as people viewing themselves as anarchists, I will say, I know this might be a little cliche at this point, but the next generation, the Zoomers, they seem to really have, like, a good idea of what's going on. Like, you know, I'm a millennial, so I think that when I did kind of come of age, I still had a little bit of an idea that maybe things would be okay eventually. But it's, you know, now I'm living through like my third once in a lifetime, economic downturn. But, you know, it does seem to me that like a lot of the people in the street were extremely young. You know, I'm like in my 30s and I felt like older there. And I do have hope that they seem very comfortable describing their politics very bluntly, and they seem to be far more to the left. So even if they're not using the word anarchist, they do seem to be, at the very least, there seems to be more anti-capitalist coming out of this like kind of younger milieu. Also, I am on TikTok, and I gotta say, the Zoomers have some great propaganda on there. Like, they're really doing a great job. So, yeah.
I think people are definitely really open to more leftist ideas, like, with or without the label, than they have been. Like, I was talking to someone, about like someone who I don't know very well about their politics, and this person was like, oh, I think I'm kind of like a centrist. And I was like, oh, really? And kind of, you know, dug in a little bit, and, you know, they ended up being like, well, you know, I'm really definitely like, don't think capitalism is good. And then also we started talking about representative democracy, and I was like, oh, well, have you heard of like direct democracy? And they were like, oh, that sounds amazing. Like, I'd get to make actual decisions, right? So it's like this person I started this conversation with saying not even that they were liberal, but they were sort of a centrist, and then were completely open and excited about ideas that were very, like, you know, much more like anarchist ideas, even started by saying they were anti-capitalist. So I think like people are really open to those things, those thoughts, in a way that they haven't been in the past, even if they are still scared by the labels of like anarchist, socialist, communist, whatever.
I'd also say that I think the label that was really in the forefront this year was abolitionist. And I think that that's awesome, because I think that you can't be an abolitionist for long without starting to understand how capitalism like intersects with all of these things that we're fighting. So I feel like that just got so much attention and press, where people are like, oh, wait, what is this new thing? Like, we're defunding the police. Now we're abolishing the police. I can be an abolitionist. And I think that like the seeds of that have not really like come to fruition yet. And I'm really excited to see like where this like new wave of abolitionists go with everything they've learned in the past year or so.
Cross the border, 1984. Tape recorder, slaughter. Sony Walkman order. Still can't drink the water. Sorta serious, like Cool C and Steady B before the murder case. Teachers start with decimals. We never learned our place. Love's gone, new era done, and all the dust gone. But funny how that heroin's back. Look where the drugs gone. People see my facial expression, they be like, what's wrong? Need to pull a Jonathan Jackson until the judge gone. A pleasure principle, principal pleasure. It's putting pressure on the system with machetes tucking the dresses. Never lesser, fresher since an embryo or an indigo. Slave revolts where rivers flow. Take over your riverboat. Simmers though, a simple quote. Straight up like strippers go. Since one scream, here we go. Lee jeans and stripper bows. My rhymes be sicker, bro. Like a sip of fifth of Irish rose. Wild style, aerosol, your Irish. Sometimes I rhyme slow. Sometimes I rhyme quick. Sometimes I burn sage. Sometimes my nine spit. Sometimes I stay at home. I'm tired of nonsense. Don't trust that po-po anytime. Got calm sense. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Sometimes I burn sage, sometimes my nine spit. Sometimes I stay at home, I'm tired of nonsense. Don't trust that government anytime, got common sense. This be that
Butterfinger crunch, brown and tan. MCMs for Depardin. I'll be sure buttons on the jacket's end. In effect mode, death cold as she's stalking us. If you got melanin, many men be talking us. Ain't no stopping us, Miss Fat and White. I got a special brand of fresh daddy on my patent is tight. Rapidly right, see my flat skin, bring up the light. Genius of love, Tauntaun Club, bring it tonight. Play me some dub, vampires still bringing the bite. Bring me some love, never enough for these bars to recite. My bars hard like peppermint bark, or simply being women walking down the street or taking steps in the park. Respect them, excellence par, little dude is too. Not in the club with Masood, but he do be crew. This dead critical, VA, pre-83, Whitaker, sweet pea, two finger rings, throwing up peace. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Sometimes I burn sage, sometimes my nine spit. Sometimes I stay at home, I'm tired of nonsense. Don't trust that po-po anytime, got calm sense. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Sometimes I burn sage, sometimes my nine spit. Sometimes I stay at home, I'm tired of nonsense. Don't trust that government anytime, got calm sense. This my baby boy. My baby boy, ha. I see you, Masood. 2399. I love you. Naeem too. Simile. RBG.
Well, now I wanted to turn towards anti-fascism, and before we were recording, we were kind of talking about that. There's been mostly good news in terms of that. There's been like a kind of like a drop in far right activity.
New York really has, like, over the last 4 years, really rose to the occasion of anti-fascist organizing and really was able to, you know, call the actions when they were needed and really, you know, really make it like, you know, fascists are not welcome in our town, feeling. And I think I'm really proud of, you know, being in, you know, in part of a community and an org, you know, a movement that, you know, was able to do that. I think the last like year or so, it hasn't really been in the forefront just because there's been so much like mutual aid going on and, you know, with COVID and the rebellion and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think, which is kind of good, right? That it's like, we don't want to be fighting fascists all the time. Like, we want to be doing all this other, important work as well. So I think it's been, you know, I think that's been great. We also, we do have an episode about anti-fascist organizing, and in there we talk about, how, like, you know, it isn't just those street actions, you know, which is what we talked about earlier, you know, I feel like that's kind of part of our thing. But, you know, that it is also, like, building these resilient communities and, like, really having a community that is, you know, looking out for each other, and that community self-defense is, like, so much more than, you know, going and punching a Proud Boy, as fun as that might be. So yeah, those are some of my thoughts about, like, anti-fascism in New York in the last couple years.
Yeah, I also wanted to add to that, you know, as anti-fascist, we all know that this is sort of a three-way fight. Like, there's the state on one side and the, like, you know, far right, you know, non-state fascist entities on the other hand. So, you know, after the, January 6th, whatever you want to call it, coup attempt, gathering at the Capitol, you know, Biden came out and was like, we need a new law against, like, terrorism or something. So that's what the Democrats are giving us, is, like, a new law. And we all know that that's going to be, like, just turned around on left-wing activists. So I think that it's great to sort of, like, celebrate Trump being gone. Like, that would have been horrible to have him for, like, another 4 years. I think it's great to sort of, like, in New York, feel like, okay, maybe the Proud Boys aren't as bold anymore. Maybe they're not doing as much anymore. That's great. But obviously we all know that, like, ICE is still, something we're going to have to deal with. DHS is still something we're going to have to deal with. And to me, that's part of, like, the anti-fascist struggle.
I wanted to ask, you know, there's a variety of different groups and spaces in New York. You know, I won't list them all. But you know, what is your thought? Is there a benefit in the variety of all that? Has that, what's that mix been like, and kind of what are the strengths and weaknesses that you see in the various kind of like organizational groupings?
You know, we talk a little bit about this in our, mental health episode, actually, oddly enough, but there's really a need in social movements for, like, every type of group, for, like, small closed groups, for, like, big open groups, for groups that specialize, for groups that educate. Like, there's a need for every group. So I'd say that, there's always a place for kind of like new formations to try things out, especially in New York, because it is a very large city, like geographically and just by population. One of the pros that I think that like we have really appreciated is that you can learn a lot from different groups. So like one group might have a completely different theory of change than another group, but they both might actually have something to sort of like bring to the movement at that moment. They might both have like different tactics, like, and you can learn from all those experiences and all those people, and all those organizers. And there's always somebody working on everything. So, you know, you have groups that are like dedicated to writing letters and groups that are dedicated to sending, books to people that are incarcerated. And there's just like, yeah, there's just like a plethora of different things to try. The one con I think is that sometimes people have trouble finding the right place, because there's just like, you can go to a different group or get in touch with a different group like every week and you would still just be like cycling through groups, I think. Like there's just like a lot of different places to get involved in different things. And so people tend to sometimes kind of cycle through groups. There's sort of like a transience a little bit. I think that's sort of like part of that is fine. People just need to like look for the place that they want to get involved. But I think it can sometimes be a little overwhelming in New York. And then especially just speaking to the podcast, I think we've really enjoyed being able to learn from so many people in New York. And we sort of try to broadcast all these different experiences that we have firsthand, experience with, because, you know, not everyone lives in such like a densely populated area. So, I think it's really helped the podcast kind of like, just help the podcast like get a lot of different perspectives.
Yeah, it's funny you brought up mental health because I didn't initially think of that with this question. But one thing that I like to kind of emphasize when I'm talking to people about activism is that it's like, you know, no one person can do everything. Like you need to like focus and pick a thing and kind of like dig into it for the long term. And I think that's also true of like organizations, right? That it's like we're never going to have one organization to rule them all, right? We really need an ecology of a movement where we have everyone work, you know, lots of different organizations working on different things in different ways that are reaching different people. So I really think it is important to have different, a lot of different groups that can do the work that needs to be done in whatever area they're, you know, focused on.
What do you all see happening the next year? I mean, we all don't have a crystal ball, but I'm just curious, your predictions or your thoughts or your hopes.
Yeah, I think like you said, we don't have a crystal ball. I think anyone who thinks they know what's going to happen next year or the coming years is, you know, definitely wrong. But as, you know, many people have said, it does feel sort of like 2020 was like the first chapter of something bigger, of bigger things to come. And, you know, the crises that we're facing are not going anywhere. You know, climate change, housing, police brutality, the pandemic, even like, you know, these are long-term crises and they've always been crises. You know, like I think, you know, COVID really had a lot more broader set of people come to understand all these crises, but they've always been there and they'll always be there to come. So I think like, you know, it's really, my hope is that, you know, really people get involved, you know, in long-term organizing, they do the work, and we kind of like work towards a future, that is more, you know, supports human life in a way that our society doesn't right now. So, you know, get involved, build resilient organizations, build communities. And that's my hope for the next couple years.
I guess just like as kind of like a closing thought, we did just want to remind people to check out Rebel Steps on our website or wherever you get your podcast. Cause we also have on the website, we do have a lot of resources, but we also have full transcripts of all our episodes. So if you know somebody who doesn't like listening to podcasts or can't check out the transcripts, but kind of to play off of what Amy was saying with just like hoping people, get involved, I think that if, whoever's listening to this right now, if you're like a leftist or somebody who's already involved, I think that now is a really good time to reach out to people around you and try and get them involved. Like, because the past year has been so like just shaking everything up, people are open to new ideas. So, you know, talk to your coworkers about starting a union, talk to your neighbors about starting eviction defense. And if you need help, you can send them Rebel Steps episodes to get them started in the right direction. You know, we might not know what's going to happen in 2020, but we can be, we might not know what's going to happen beyond 2020 in 2021 and 2022. We might not know, but we can be part of like creating that future together.
Yeah. Right. The future is not written. I think it's important to remember that like we can influence what, you know, where the future goes. The future is not just like happening to us, you know, so now's the time. You know, let's influence what the future looks like.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.